Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and what is expected to be a pitched battle over the president's judicial nominees and the right to filibuster them has begun in the U.S. Senate. This morning, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist called for debate to begin on Federal Appeals Court nominee Priscilla Owen, the first of seven nominations that have been stalled for years by Democrats.
Either confirm these nominees or reject the nominees, but don't leave them hanging. Don't leave our courts hanging. Don't leave the country hanging.
But Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid says unless a compromise can be reached, Democrats will try to block the nominees through endless debate in a filibuster. And he also criticized Republicans for calling that a gimmick.
The filibuster is not a scheme, and it certainly isn't new. The filibuster is far from a procedural gimmick. It's part of the fabric of this institution we call the Senate.
And that is expected to prompt Republicans to trigger the so-called nuclear option, which would lower the number of votes it would take to ban filibusters. Well, joining us on the line from the Senate building is Terrence Samuel, congressional correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. And Terrence, you've been watching this debate on the Senate floor. As we said, Frist began by calling for debate on the nomination of Texas Supreme Court Justice Priscilla Owen to the Federal Appeals Court in New Orleans. So what happens now?
I think you've begun to get a sense of what's going to happen for the next 2 days. There's going to be a lot of talking, a lot of high-flown speeches, a lot of people making arguments not just about the procedure ahead, but kind of the larger context of this, which is this huge ideological divide in the country, and one side thinking that the one thing standing in their way, meaning the right and conservatives, and particularly evangelical Christians, that the federal judiciary is kind of out of control, and this is the beginning of a fight to try to tame that.
Well, a couple questions as you observe there. First of all, is anyone talking about Ms. Owens?
I think you're going to hear a lot about Ms. Owen. The beginning of the debate began with two senators from Texas who were going to talk a lot about what they know. Senator Cornyn, who actually served on the Supreme Court with Ms. Owen at one point, and certainly knows her well from his time in Texas. And the Democrats have certainly said that they are going to make an issue not just of the procedural changes and what they think is this great infringement on the checks and balances of the Constitution, but the merits of why they think these unacceptable nominees ought not to go forward. So I think at some point we're going to hear a lot about Ms. Owen.
Well, and clarify for us, because we've had people even here asking the question, when do you know that it's a filibuster? In other words, if people are standing up and debating, when do you know that it becomes a filibuster and not just the expected debate?
It becomes a filibuster when the other side would like you to sit down and be quiet, and when you refuse. And I think we're going to know that sometime on Friday when the majority asked for either a motion to proceed to a vote, file a motion for cloture, any number of procedural gimmicks, though I don't want to use that word today, and the other side objects. And that's when we know that that this thing is headed for a confrontation.
Right. And you mentioned cloture. That's when 16 senators present a motion to end the debate, and it then takes 60 senators to agree and invoke cloture. And that's, as you said, when the mathematical configuration of the Senate
could... It actually comes to bear. And thanks for explaining that.
It's quite all right. And by the way, did you know that the term filibuster comes from a Dutch word meaning pirate, which I just learned today? Well, tell us, what do you expect to happen over until Friday? Is it just going to be this kind of back-and-forth debate?
I think it is going to be back-and-forth debate, but I think in the debate you see both the context of what this is and the subtext. The context is, quite frankly, this is kind of the undercard, kind of the trial heat for a huge fight over what is expected to be a very contentious Supreme Court nomination sometime this summer or later.
Right.
And a lot of what we hear about these judges is a concern about who gets to sit on the Supreme Court and make all these crucial decisions about these ideological and cultural war issues, as they've been midterms. The other thing is that, you know, there are people in the Senate interested in being president, and
Bill Frist being one of them.
Bill Frist being one of them, and a lot of this is, one, kind of positioning ahead of the 2008 campaign, and in some ways kind of a payback or payoff for support that evangelicals and Christian conservatives provided to Republicans in increasing their numbers in the Senate and winning the White House. And they're basically saying, we are the crux of this party. We are responsible for these recent victories, and this is what we want. This is what we demand.
Well, Terrence, so we're going to have some more analysis in a moment, but before we let you go, is there any chance at this hour of a compromise, or is that completely over?
I will quote Senator Lott, who coined the term nuclear option. There is always a chance, and you know, quite frankly, there was a sense in the last day or so that we may be seeing kind of a typical Senate tango where you basically dance right up to the edge of the precipice and then somebody comes and sweeps you off with a helicopter or something. But I would say the chances of that are slim, very, very slim.
Terrence Samuel, congressional correspondent for U.S. News and World Report at today's Senate hearings. Terrence, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So what does all this talk about a possible filibuster of the nomination of judges mean for the Senate as an institution, for American politics? We turn now to congressional expert Ilona Nichols, scholar at the Center on Congress at Indiana University. Hello, Ilona.
Good morning, Robin.
And Mark Schmidt. He's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington and a former staffer to Democratic Senator Bill Bradley. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
And before we start with the issue of filibusters, can we just do some quick fact-checking with you? I want to first listen to how Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist today kicked off this debate.
We don't want the constitutional option. We didn't ask for the constitutional option. What has happened because of the other side of the aisle in shattering the Senate tradition for 214 years, where filibuster was never even contemplated, now it's being used on a routine basis. One out of every four of the president's nominees that have come over for the circuit courts are filibustered, blocked.
Mark Schmidt, go to you first. So many things there. We should note that Frist used the phrase constitutional option instead of nuclear option, but he also said that Democrats changed the filibuster rules in the last Congress. Is that true?
Right. No, that is a new talking point that has emerged about 2 days ago, that the practice of filibustering a number of nominees is in itself a rules change. And, of course, it's not a rules change. It's always been infrequent. It's infrequent now, but there have been filibusters on judicial nominees before. Abe Fortas's nomination to become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in 1968 was filibustered. There's some belief that he might not have had a majority support, but that was never put to the test before President Johnson was forced to withdraw the nomination. So it's certainly not unprecedented. It's not a rules change on the Democrats' part. It's an interesting little piece of spin that they've used to make it seem that they're somehow changing the rules back as opposed to, in fact, quite radically changing the rules themselves.
And Ilona, just touching base with you, Mr. Frist said one out of four of the president's nominees have been blocked. Our understanding was that a couple hundred at least of the president's nominees have been passed and only seven, I believe, are blocked.
Well, I want to go back to what Mark said. You're right. There's seven that are formally blocked, but I disagree with Mark's perspective. I think this is a tragic confrontation, and it's being presented as a Democrat versus Republican or an ideological conservative versus liberal fight. I think it's an institutional tragedy. And the fact that there have been an occasional individual vote on cloture on various nominations throughout 214 years of Senate history doesn't make it a precedent to be used in a patterned way against a whole block of people today. I don't think that's justification. In Fortas's case, he was already on the Supreme Court. And he was
Abe Fortas,
and he was being elevated, or Johnson wanted to elevate him to be the Chief Justice. He was already under an ethical cloud. There were already members of both parties opposed to him because of the ethical cloud. It simply isn't strong precedent to say because there was a cloture vote, which acted as a test vote on Fortas, that you have cleared the way and opened the door to use filibusters on judicial nominations ever more in the, into the future. I don't buy that at all.
Well, and obviously you are against it, whether or not it's a rules change or, as you say, just not the right thing to do. You are against it. Why?
Because filibusters are an important part of the Senate's procedures. They are valid. They help define the Senate as having a different mission statement from the House on legislation. But on judicial nominees, you are dealing with a new element, and that is the constitutional role of the president. The Constitution's language is the president shall, that means must, do the appointing of nominees. It doesn't say as vetted by the minority party. It says with the advice and consent of the Senate, and I think there's legitimate upset about the lack of consultation and what advice means and should mean, and that debate is a good one to have.
And by the way, Ilona, we want to point out that you've said to us that you could care less which side is calling for the filibuster.
Absolutely.
This is about the law. Well, I just want to stop you there. Congressional scholar Norman Ornstein disagrees with you, Ilona. He writes in Roll Call today that he's yet to read anything about some long-standing tradition, custom, or unwritten rule against filibustering judicial nominees. And Mark, I want you to jump in. You also disagree in that you feel that they are useful. Why?
Well, I actually have the opposite perspective from Ms. Nichols, in that I think it's more important to have the filibuster on judicial nominees because judges serve for life, and they serve well beyond the current Congress. So the configuration of today's majority will be shaped for years to come by the court in the way that, for example, the Supreme Court severely limited a lot of the things, a lot of the New Deal, a lot of what a majority wanted to do in the early 1930s because of judges who'd been appointed long before. Judges have a long hand into the future, and that's the very reason for our temporary majority to fully account for the strongly held views of a minority. And I agree with Norm Ornstein on this very strongly. There's nothing in the precedents of the Senate that says one should never filibuster judicial nominees. One does it rarely. A filibuster should be hard work.
Well, and you both represent the tension in the Senate today. But I just want to ask Mark you one question, because you've actually been in the middle of that tension. You actually prepared a filibuster for Senator Bill Bradley years ago. In the seconds we have, how much did you have to immerse yourself in? I believe it was mining issues.
Yeah,
it was a
filibuster on the Utah Wilderness Bill, which would have opened a lot of Utah to development. And Senator Bradley, because of his committee position, was filibustered it.
And hours of reading books
hours
and writing
research.
The material.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, one of the things I learned is too often they let the filibuster just be a supermajority. They just take a cloture vote, and if it doesn't get 60 votes, they say, okay, they withdraw the nomination. I think that's a mistake. I think filibuster should be a measure of intensity of opposition, and you should make, if people want to filibuster to block something, you should make them talk. You should make them make the case over a long period of time.
Well, if that happens, and if it happens over the next couple of days, we want to invite you both back to weigh in on it. We really appreciate your time. Ilona Nichols, congressional scholar at the Center on Congress at Indiana University. We'd love to invite you back. Mark Schmidt, former staffer to Senator Bill Bradley and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington. We'll watch what happens from here and hope you can watch it with us. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Why is the chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting so upset with PBS and NPR? CPB Chair Kenneth Tomlinson is reportedly considering a plan to monitor NPR programs for anti-Israel bias, and he told his staff that it should redirect funding away from news and towards music programs. Tomlinson also reportedly hired a private consultant to monitor the PBS show Now, and the CPB has appointed two ombudsmen to monitor both radio and television content. Mark Jerkowitz covers media affairs for the Boston Globe. He joins us in our studio to map out the terrain on this story. Mark, welcome.
You're welcome.
And first of all, define the CPB. What is the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
Well, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is an entity that was set up essentially to disperse some federal funding to public broadcasting. Now, it frankly, was probably one of the least known governmental bodies in history until about a year or so ago when it started to get a little more invasive into public broadcasting programming. And it's staffed by presidential appointees. And it also sort of adheres to a law that seems to have sort of dual purposes. One of the purposes that Ken Tomlinson is interested in is the aspect of law that says it's to ensure balance, whatever that means, in public broadcasting programming. But the other mandate is to sort of protect public broadcasting from the vagaries and the mercurial aspect of politics and partisanship.
It's supposed to be a buffer.
Exactly. A firewall, so to speak.
Between politicians and broadcasters.
Exactly. And in point of fact, right now I think there are a lot of people who sort of see it as a conduit between a bunch of politicians and public broadcasting.
And that brings us to Kenneth Tomlinson, who is the current chair, who is an avowed conservative.
Yep, and who has made it quite clear that he really believes that there is a liberal bias in public broadcasting. And we should give a little background on this. This is an old story that takes on new incarnations every once in a while. Let's not forget that roughly 10 years ago, when Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House, he threatened to zero out funding for public broadcasting because conservatives were very, very angry with public broadcasting at that point. In the late 1990s, I believe, there was another scandal in which some public broadcasting stations and entities were involved in swapping donor lists, largely with Democratic organizations. That started another sort of firestorm on Capitol Hill. Now we're on to a sort of a third wave that's kind of being led by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and they have made it clear, A, that they're interested in monitoring the kind of programming that's on public broadcasting, both public radio and public television. They have funded some programming and given seed money to certain programs, most notably Tucker Carlson's program and the Wall Street Journal program on PBS. And he has made it clear that he wants to use sort of the authority of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, not to get rid of liberals, as he says, on public broadcasting, but to balance the scales between liberalism and conservatism. And that's a debate in and of itself.
Well, NPR executives say that they're concerned about editorial influence on programs from the CPB. Critics of NPR from the left, by the way, are laughing at descriptions of NPR as too liberal. They say it's become too mainstream. That's a topic for another day. But what's been other reaction?
There's now a real sense that public broadcasting is becoming a political football. And some people have understandably called for public broadcasting to sort of sever its public funding ties. And, you know, the best way, some people would suggest, to get out of this conundrum is to essentially stop taking public funding so that the enemies of public broadcasting or those who seek to change it constantly can't be yelling about taxpayer-funded broadcasting, which is overestimated anyway.
Well, let's talk about the money, because conservative talk show hosts on commercial radio often say that NPR is fully funded by taxpayers. We, of course, are produced by a public radio station, WBUR, here in Boston. This station receives about 6% of its funding from CPB funds. NPR overall receives about 1% of its funding from CPB.
Right, exactly. And frankly, the influence on television isn't that great. The money isn't that great. But there's an idea that's been created in the public's mind that next to national defense, you know, more of your taxpayer dollars go to public broadcasting. But it is public broadcasting, and it does give Congress and their appointees and political appointees and people with a political point of view some say in, you know, how public broadcasting operates. And that may be the fundamental problem.
Chair Tomlinson commissioned a poll to prove that most Americans found PBS biased. But the poll showed that most Americans disagreed with him. So he commissioned a second poll, which came in with even stronger numbers showing that most people think public radio, public television, more fair, more balanced than other programming.
Well, one of two things is going on here. And I've talked to people in the public broadcasting system with Ken Tomlinson. And the question really is Ken Tomlinson going to dig in here? Okay, are the ombudsman of the CPB going to really start to really monitor programming closely? Are they going to start to visit stations? Is he really going to get down to that level and start exercising the levers of power, making decisions about where funding is going to go in a way that's going to affect programming? Or essentially, is he? And I don't mean this, but is he posturing in a way that he is hoping that just by, you know, bringing political pressure and noise into the debate, that the system is sort of going to acquiesce in certain ways, such as putting on Tucker Carlson or his ilk, And he'll be satisfied. That's not clear.
In the meantime, two congressmen, Dingell and Obie, both Democrats, have asked, as you said, the agency's inspector general to look into reports that Tomlinson hired a private consultant without the board's knowing to monitor now.
One program only.
Right. The congressman again saying that what he's doing violates the law that sets up that the CPP was supposed to serve as a shield rather than a source of political interference. What do you think? How do you think Congress is going to react further to this?
In partisan fashion. There's plenty of blame to go around on both sides. Jeff Chester, who's the president of the Center for Digital Democracy, who's a great and liberal sort of media activist, will tell you that both sides have loved right. to stack the deck. This is not simply one side or the other. And as far as these inquiries go, I will give you a simple equation. The two Congress people who are asking for an inquiry are Democrats. The Democrats are essentially not in the White House, a minority in the House and a minority in the Senate, and frankly, you know, we'll be lucky to get lunch ordered on Capitol Hill in the next 3 or 4 years with Republicans controlling everything. So I would be predisposed to think that nothing concrete will come out of their complaints other than, again, they're sort of adding fuel to the political debate.
Mark Cherkowitz, media analyst for the Boston Globe. Mark, thank you.
You're welcome.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, American soldiers ambushed and outgunned, a reporter's firsthand account of a harrowing battle in Iraq. Plus, Pink Martini brings back the sounds of Cuban bossa nova. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Buy a dozen ears of corn at the supermarket, peel back the husk, and you'll see seeds that trace their genetic roots to Mexico. Indigenous farmers in Mexico have been growing corn for thousands of years. Today, though, these farmers are struggling for survival. What's at stake is not just their livelihoods, but the genetic source material for one of the world's major food crops. Our series on the impact of free trade on Mexico continues with this report from Mary Lozier.
Jesus León farms in the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca, in the steep, dry hills known as the Mixteca Alta. They are named for the Mixteca Indians to whom León traces his lineage. Like his ancestors, León grows corn. A heap of ears lies just outside the family's kitchen door, piled under a thatched awning. León pulls back the husks to reveal shining colors, brilliant scarlet, deep blue, translucent white. Other ears are multicolored. Each color has a different use, León says. Blue corn is good to plant if the rains come late. White corn is prized for making tortillas, but it's harder to grow.
When it is only one color, like this for example, there's a good chance that if not much rain falls, the plants won't produce. But normally, the ones that have many colors, they're very safe. They resist drought. It is almost certain they will grow well.
Each year, León and his family save seed from each of the different colors of corn and use it to plant the next year's crop. But farmers here live hard lives. León tills his tiny plot with an ox-drawn wooden plow of a type that dates back to the Spanish conquest. He and his family pick and shell the corn by hand. He says his own children aren't sure they want to be campesinos. Campesino is a Spanish word sometimes translated as peasant farmer.
Siempre estamos platicando con los hijos.
We're always talking with them about the importance of being a campesino. To be a campesino is not to be ignorant. It is having much or more ability as anyone who lives in the city. We're trying to make this group, campesinos, exist forever. We have to fight.
On the wall of the tiny windowless room where he sits in the doorway shelling corn, there's a poster with anti-globalization slogans. León belongs to an organization of farmers trying to find ways to stay on their land, something the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, has made much harder to do. With corn imported from the U.S. flooding into Mexico, he and others in the dry hills of the Mixteca Alta suddenly find themselves in competition with the highly mechanized farmers of the American Midwest, farmers who till the flat, rich soil of Iowa or Illinois. In the years since NAFTA, the Mexican government has drastically cut subsidies for Mexican farmers, while the American government has continued its hefty subsidies for American farmers. León takes a handful of dark blue corn and shifts it from palm to palm as he speaks.
I
do not know what Mexico was thinking when they signed the free trade agreement under those conditions. We believe it is really to eliminate the campesino sector. They think it would be easier to buy corn from the U.S. than to grow it in Mexico.
Son terrazas, terrazas para trabajar, para sembrar.
50 miles east of the Mixteca Alta, people in the tile-roofed village of Capalalpam are also worried about corn imported from the United States. It was here in 2001 that laboratory tests discovered that genes from genetically modified U.S. corn had somehow slipped into fields cultivated by indigenous farmers, even though Mexico bans the planting of genetically modified corn. The source of the transgenes is believed to be U.S. corn intended for human consumption that was instead planted by unknowing local farmers. Lillian Perez Santiago is an agronomist who oversees the lab that discovered the genetically altered corn. She's also a Zapotec Indian who works for an organization of indigenous groups, which called meetings to warn villagers.
To explain molecular biology to a person who doesn't have any idea that molecular biology exists, it's very complicated. We gave examples until the people understood, because they are intelligent, they understand what they have.
Up the hill from where Perez works, past small plots of corn and peas clinging to the terraced hillsides, Miguel Ramirez teaches at the local agricultural school. He says Mexico, the birthplace of corn, is the wrong country for transgenics.
There are places, there are countries where they suffer hunger and transgenics are necessary. If it helps increase production, then fine. But here in the center of origin, I think not.
Ramirez and others filed a petition requesting an investigation into the spread of genetically modified corn here. They sent it to the Canadian offices of what's known as the Commission for Environmental Cooperation. The commission was set up under NAFTA to monitor the treaty's environmental effects. Last year, the commission issued a report. In it, an international panel of scientists called for U.S. genetically modified corn to be ground up at the border so it couldn't be used as seed in Mexico. The U.S. has denounced the recommendation, and the Mexican government has not implemented it. The scientists also warned about what they called the erosion of genetic diversity in corn. The scientists cautioned that storing corn in gene banks is not enough to preserve Mexico's wealth of corn genetics. What's also needed is what the scientists call in situ conservation. In other words, for Mexico's peasant farmers to keep growing the brightly colored corn they have tended for so long. Each year, the village of San Bartolo in the Mixteca Alta holds a festival for its patron saint. Buses, pickup trucks, and communal taxis labor up the rough road to the village's school and its pretty hilltop church. Many in the crowd watching the basketball games and milling around the refreshment stands were born here but have moved away. Among them is Juan Ramirez, who works as a maintenance man in Mexico City.
No hay muchos medios para poder sobrevivir.
There are not a lot of ways to live here, corn and wheat and beans, but the crops were poor. There is no rain. There is no irrigation here.
Ramirez says he thinks the Mexican government has abandoned villages like his.
In Mexico City, the government gives away buildings and highways and houses. They should do that in the countryside, not in Mexico City.
Among the crowd of older women waiting by the restrooms, not one has a grown-up child who has remained at the village. Their children have gone to Mexico City or to the United States to find work. There they wash cars or sell fruit, the women say. They come back for the fiesta, bringing coffee and sugar, because there is none here. Scientists say it is this exodus from Mexican villages like San Bartolo that presents one of the greatest threats to corn's genetic diversity. This story has a postscript. Back in 1970, a blight struck the American Corn Belt. It swept unimpeded across the farms of Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, and other Midwest states. So scientists traveled back to Mexico looking for resistant genes to breed into the U.S. corn crop. And in Mexico, in those days, they could still find them.
That report from Mary Lozier, it's part of Think Global, Public Radio's week of special coverage of globalization. You're listening to Here and Now. Tens of millions of women are being told that they might be at risk for fractures because they have low bone density. And they're also being told to take bone-strengthening prescription drugs such as Fosamax, Actonel, or Evista. But are these necessary? That's the question that Here and Now health columnist Judy Foreman asks this week, and she joins us in the studio with some answers. Welcome.
Hi.
And this story starts with a diagnosis. Women get tested for bone density. Some are diagnosed with osteopenia and some with osteoporosis.
Yeah, osteopenia sounds like an intimidating word, but it just means osteo is bones and penia means not enough. So osteopenia is not quite enough bone, but it's not really a diagnosis of a disease. About 10 years ago, the World Health Organization decided to call certain scores on a bone density test osteopenia, not enough bone, and then certain worse scores, osteoporosis. But basically, it's been very confusing ever since because they let too many people get defined as having osteopenia and actually not enough get defined as having osteoporosis.
What do you mean by that?
It means we're sort of over-diagnosing and over-treating women with this fake disease, osteopenia, and not catching enough people with real osteoporosis, which can lead to seriously broken bones.
So osteopenia is not a disease, and it's certainly not as serious a condition as osteoporosis, which is a disease?
It's a condition, yeah. I mean, you could call it a disease. I mean, that's very fragile bones, in which what they call the microarchitecture of the bones, or the structure of the bones, is all messed up, and that can easily lead to fractures. But it's also got to be said that a lot of people fracture their bones with perfectly normal bone density. So it's a very confusing picture.
Does osteopenia always lead to osteoporosis?
Not always. You can sort of stay osteopenic for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It often does, but it doesn't necessarily lead to osteoporosis. The problem is that if you tell every woman with mild osteopenia that she's got a problem and put all these women on drugs, that's not a good idea.
Because, let's talk more about these drugs. Are bone strengthening drugs safe to take? I mean, hip fractures are, you know, can be deadly,
fatal
for older women. But, you know, what is the thinking about the drugs that might prevent that?
Well, Fosamax is probably the most used, and there was a study not too long ago in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed it seems to be safe to take it for up to 10 years. The problem is, if you're 50 years old and you're told you have mild bone loss and you start taking Fosamax, you're not going to probably break your bones till you're in your 80s, so you could be taking this drug for 30 years. Mm. Same with Actonel, same with Evista. I mean, a lot of these drugs can cause little ulcers in your esophagus. You have to take them and then not lie down for a while. And they also, these drugs wind up in your bones. They get incorporated into the material of bones. So if 10 or 20 years from now it turns out that there is a danger with these drugs, a lot of people will already have these drugs kind of permanently stuck in their bones.
Right. So what is your suggestion to women who are, you know, 50 or 60 years old and are getting bone density tests that show that they, you know, have mild bone density loss?
Well, first of all, every woman who at 65 should have a bone density test. If you have risk factors for osteoporosis, like your parent, your mother had it or your sisters have had it, if you're a smoker, if you've broken a bone already without much provocation, like a very minor fall, you should start being screened at 60 or even below if you have a strong family history. The question is what to do with a sort of a mildly, quote-unquote, abnormal score on the osteopenia test. And that is, you know, talk to your doctor. And if your only indication of potential trouble down the line is a mildly abnormal osteopenia score, it's maybe best to do nothing and just repeat the bone density in a couple of years. If you have a low score plus some other things, you're a smoker or your mother had osteoporosis, then it might make sense to start treating.
And there are things that you can do to prevent bone loss.
That's absolutely right. You can do weightlifting, which everybody should do 3 times a week or so. The weights don't have to be heavy. You should walk briskly 30 minutes a day. Take enough vitamin D and calcium, and that's basically 800 units a day of vitamin D and 1,200 to 1,500 of calcium. And there are other things, too, to prevent falls, because in most cases, it's the fall that causes the actual break in the bone. You cannot take too many drugs like Valium, which can make you unsteady on your feet. A lot of people break a hip or some other part of their body rushing to the bathroom because they have overactive bladder. Mm. A lot of people slip on rugs because their eyesight is bad. You can kind of detoxify your house to make it less likely that you're going to fall, too.
Here now, health columnist Judy Foreman. Judy, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And to read her column on low bone density and bone strengthening drugs, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And in the news this hour, while the Senate debates the president's judicial nominees, the House is taking up the issue of steroid use in professional sports. Commissioners and union representatives from all major league sports, football, baseball, hockey, basketball, and soccer, are taking the stand on Capitol Hill today and tomorrow. Congressman Cliff Stearns, Republican of Florida and chair of the House Subcommittee on Energy and Trade, says he's not convinced players and leagues can police themselves. He offered these recommendations.
I, along with many of my colleagues, believe the best solution includes a comprehensive and uniform drug testing rules, procedures, and penalties for all professional sports.
But before a federal uniform drug policy is put in place, some of the leagues want to toughen their own rules. NBA Commissioner David Stern told the committee he wants to kick out players who fail a third steroid test and double punishment for first-time offenders. Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig pledged to get behind lawmakers if the Baseball Players Union does not agree to toughen its own policy. The National Hockey League currently doesn't test for performance-enhancing substances. Of course, they currently don't do much given the prolonged lockout, but the league plans to add random testing when players return in the fall. Ever wonder where food trends begin and why certain foods are featured so prominently in grocery stores or restaurants, food magazines? Well, many of the people behind the decision-making process attended this year's annual International Association of Culinary Professionals in Dallas, Texas, which is where we sent Here Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst, and she has returned with her report. Welcome back, Kathy.
Hello, Robin.
And tell us more about this conference.
Well, there were 1,200 food professionals from 22 countries, and this is a conference where, as you might guess, it's chefs, food writers, restaurant owners, caterers, and they all come to talk and eat. There's a lot of talking and a lot of eating. There are workshops on a huge variety of topics, everything from how to write a cookbook to how to excel in food photography. There was an entire workshop given on bacon, all the new trends in bacon, how the pig should be raised, how it should be smoked, what kind of wood. I mean,
humane treatment of animals, perhaps?
Very much so. There's quite a bit of talk about that. There was a workshop on Indian street food. And everyone is there for a different reason. One of the women I spoke to is Amelia Saltzman. She's a cookbook author and a cooking teacher from Santa Monica, California.
There's a lot of finding out the why, the context of our food. Knowing sort of the past and the context of why we cook what we cook or a recipe makes me feel grounded, connected somehow to my cooking, to those that have come before me. And I think that's what I really like, and I've noticed that about a lot of the workshops. It's not just about cheese or just about barbecue. It's about how it evolved.
Amelia Saltzman, a cookbook author that Kathy met at the conference. Do some name dropping. Who else was there that we might know?
Well, there were some TV celebrities there like Jacques Pepin and Martin Yan. It's a lot of the top magazine and cookbook editors, names you may or may not know. But of course, the person that was so visibly absent was Julia Child. This is her conference. It used to be called the Julia Child Awards, and she was always at the conference. So that was somebody that was sorely missed this year.
Because she has, of course, passed. Well, what were some of the other workshops that you liked?
Well, there was a fabulous workshop about Texas barbecue, and since it was held in Dallas, you would expect barbecue to be big, but it turns out it's way bigger than Texas. You're going to be seeing in the next year barbecue ideas from India, Thailand, Vietnam, marinating meats in coconut milk, using ginger, tamarind, lime juice, and this will infiltrate into your neighbor's backyard. You'll start to see these things. Another huge trend is a Japanese grill called a Robata, and this is special Japanese charcoal, and some of the hot restaurants are now buying these grills. barbecue sales. I mean, in 2004, 14.4 million new barbecue grills were sold. Mm. This is a trend that is only getting bigger and bigger every year. I have a friend, a cookbook author, Deborah Krasner. She's writing a whole book about outdoor kitchens, and the centerpiece of outdoor kitchens are grills. So it's a trend that seems to have absolutely no boundaries.
We've been seeing a lot of outdoor fireplaces are being sold, and instead of the modern grills, almost going back to big pots where you just put fire in it.
The kettles, yeah, right. Those big open kettles. But barbecues have gotten huge. I mean, in the literal sense, physically. They now, some of them have refrigerator units under them, and it's a big, big deal.
Well, what else took your fancy?
Well, I attended a really interesting workshop about chocolate. Good old chocolate. Believe it or not, chocolate has grown up.
It's, what more can you learn about chocolate? You have researched this.
I thought I knew it all, but in fact, I don't. A woman named Alice Murdich from Berkeley, California, she's the author of an award-winning book called Bittersweet. She led close to 200 people through a tasting of different types of chocolate, talked a lot about the environment and organics and how chocolate's grown, but also taught us how to taste. And one of the things that's most confusing about chocolate these days is you'll see percentages on the labels. It'll say bittersweet chocolate 60%. Or you may be reading a cookbook that says the best brownies ever, and in the ingredient list it calls for a semi-sweet chocolate 65%. Well, what the heck is that percent? I never fully understood. So Alice finally explained it to me.
One of the big trends now is not only dark chocolate as opposed to milk chocolate, but the trend is towards increasing intensity in chocolate. And so a lot of bars you'll see will have a percentage on them. And the percentage usually ranges upward from 60%, and it's telling you how much of that bar is pure ground-up cocoa beans as opposed to sugar. Our old standard bittersweet and semi-sweet chocolates in this country only had, 50 or 55, maybe sometimes 60% cocoa beans in them. The remaining amount of the chocolate would be sugar. So these days we're seeing bars that have only 30% sugar, 20% sugar, and a whole lot more pure chocolate. And that's really a reflection of our interest in the real flavors of chocolate as opposed to just sweet candy.
Chocolate expert and writer Alice Murdich, author of the book Bittersweet. Well, Kathy, so we've gone from barbecue to chocolate. Could you just give us a couple more subjects that piqued your interest?
Besides the barbecue and the chocolate, which were truly highlights, I went to a Spanish food workshop. Now, I sat in this very studio in December with Scott Haas, and I predicted that Spanish food would continue to be hot. Bingo! She was right. Absolutely. Spanish food, it's healthy. The Spanish chefs are getting way more attention than the French and Italian chefs these days. The olive oil from Spain is outstanding and very well priced. I would say look for that. You'll start to see it a lot more in your stores. One of the most interesting workshops I went to was about kitchen science. There are biologists and chemists that are moving into the kitchen more and more. There's a fabulous woman named Shirley Currier. She is called the Kitchen Doctor, and her workshop sells out every year. 200 people come up and raise their hand, and they ask questions like, why didn't my cake rise? Why doesn't my sauce hold together? And because of her biology background, we learn about the whys. So much of this conference is about the whys in cooking.
It's as if everyone will start approaching their cooking as if we all have test kitchens.
Well, we know we don't, but there's a man named Harold McGee who's written a book called On Food and Cooking about the science and lore of this whole kitchen science. And it's really interesting to learn about this stuff. What's baking soda? What's baking powder? How does it work? How do they interact? Mm. You'll be seeing a lot more conversations like that in newspaper columns, magazine articles, and even on the radio.
Here now is resident chef Kathy Gunst with her report from the annual International Association of Culinary Professionals. She's just come back from the conference. By the way, Kathy's new cookbook is called Harvest, Celebrating the Bounty of the Seasons. And Kathy, congratulations. We understand it was one of the four nominated for Best Cookbooks American category at the IACP.
Thank you, Robin.
So congratulations to you.
Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.